It hissed and fizzed, cracking the air with its power as it whipped along the needle and into Mother's coffin. Something wasn't right, though. There was disorder to Nathaniel's process. He was doing things all wrong. He was supposed to inject Mother with the blood first, then flip the switch. But why? My mind whirled as the electrical buzz filled the air. Nathaniel raised the metal syringe, a startling realization crashing through my mind exactly 1 second too late.
No!
I shouted, my voice sucked away with the clamor. Thomas held fast to me as I struggled in his arms. I needed to run to my brother to save his miserable life. Nathaniel stared, unseeing, through me, and I cried out for him again.
No, Nathaniel, you mustn't! Let go of me!
The buzz was overwhelming. It set my teeth clattering and made breathing nearly impossible. My brother appeared unaffected. I shouted again, to no avail.
Stop this madness, Nathaniel, Father growled over the din. I said!
My brother thrust the syringe into our mother's chest, metal connecting to metal with nothing protecting him from its surge. Mother's body lurched forward before collapsing back onto the table and twitching. I tore my gaze from her, desperate to help my brother.
Nathaniel!
I screamed as he shook in place, unable to drop the metal syringe and disconnect himself from the malevolent current. A bloody stream poured from his nose and mouth, at the same time smoke rose around his collar. I wrestled and kicked like a wild animal refusing to be tamed.
Let go, Thomas! Let me go!
You cannot help him, Thomas said, his arms fused around my body, caging me. If you touch him now, you'll suffer his same fate. I'm sorry, Audrey Rose, I'm so sorry.
I sunk against Thomas, knowing he'd never let me fling myself into death. It felt like years had passed, when suddenly Nathaniel flew back from the force, his body smashing into the wall and crumpling in a heap of smoldering clothes. Silence blanketed the room, like freshly fallen snow. Everything was too quiet and too loud all at once. Even the machines had finally stopped pumping. Mother's body jolted once more, then fell still. I blinked, needing to focus on one horror at a time. My attention shifted to my brother. Nathaniel's head hung at a fatal angle, but I couldn't accept it. I wouldn't. He'd get up. He'd be sore and bruised, but he'd live. My brother was young, and he'd survive and make up for his sins. He would apologize and seek help to fix whatever had made him violent. It'd take time, but the old Nathaniel would return to us. I waited, holding my breath. He would rise. He had to. The scent of burnt hair filled the space, and I suppressed rolling nausea. I watched my father slowly collapse to his knees, covering his face with his hands and sobbing.
My precious boy.
It was too much to take in. I felt myself swaying, but had to be sure of one thing before I lost myself. I peered at Mother's body, relieved she wasn't moving. Then a terrible sadness crushed me. Nathaniel's rampage had been for naught. Please, please get up. I stared at my brother's ruined hair. I wanted him to stand up and reach for that blasted comb. He needed to fix it. He'd hate it if someone saw him that way. I silently counted to 30. It was the longest he'd ever gone without addressing disastrous hair. When I reached 31, he still hadn't moved. I fell to the ground, dry heaving as realization sank in. Nathaniel would never care about his hair again. He'd never drink another bottle of imported brandy. He'd never picnic with a hamper from Fortnum and Mason, or help me escape Father's pretty cell. He'd done horrific things, then left me to pick up the shattered pieces of our lives. Alone. I screamed until my throat was raw. Thomas tried soothing me, but all I could think was, Jack the Ripper was dead. My brother was dead. I continued screaming until darkness held me in its welcome embrace.
Chapter 30. Death to Life. Dr. Jonathan Wadsworth's Laboratory, Highgate, 23rd November, 1888.
Use the larger bone saw to cut the cranium.
Uncle's hands twitched, but he didn't reach for the blade. He knew I needed the distraction more than he needed to perform this post-mortem. I took a deep breath and pushed with all my might, moving the serrated edge back and forth. This time I wore a facial mask to avoid breathing in bone dust. I'd watched Uncle do this procedure many times now, and had learned there were some things I did not wish to be exposed to. 2 long weeks had passed since we'd buried Nathaniel next to Mother. Father was more remote than ever, and I was slowly losing myself to insanity. The house felt empty, sullen, as though mourning its own loss. It was amazing how much one person could fill up a space and leave it so hollow when they were gone. Nothing was the same, nor ever would be again. Not only did I lose my brother, I had to suffer through the knowledge of the murderer he'd been the last months of his life. Lord Edmund covered up Nathaniel's involvement. I didn't ask how. One day, I'd let everyone know the truth, but the pain was too raw now. A tear slid down my cheek, but I continued sawing into the skull, not bothering to wipe it away. Some days were better than others. On good days, I only cried myself to sleep. On the bad, I found myself tearing up randomly throughout the day.
Good. Now, lift the top part of the skull up,
Uncle said, motioning toward the top half. It reminded me of the small side of an egg.
Might offer some resistance at first, but it'll suction off with the right amount of pressure. Stick the scalpel in and pry it.
I did as I was instructed. The top of the skull pulled off with a slurping noise, not unlike a sealed jar being opened. An unpleasant scent lingered in the space around us, apparent even through my mask. Thomas coughed, drawing my attention briefly to him. Truthfully, I'd forgotten he was even here. He'd been quietly perched in the corner of the laboratory, writing notes and studying my brother's journals. I couldn't bear to read them just yet, though from what I'd heard, they contained breakthrough science. My brother's autumn of terror might end up being used for good one day after all. It was Thomas's hope he'd be able to perform a successful transplant on a living person during his lifetime. I didn't doubt it. Uncle handed me a tray and I set the upper portion of the skull on it.
Now, you'll want to remove this little piece of the brain, here.
Uncle used a scalpel to point out the specimen. I plucked the scalpel from his hands and brought it to the brain, when a knock came at the door. A servant popped her head in and forced her eyes to the ground. I couldn't blame her. There was nothing beautiful about decay.
Lord Wadsworth is in the parlour. He'd like to speak with Miss Audrey Rose, sir.
Uncle made an exasperated sound and tossed his hands in the air.
Then tell Lord Wadsworth he'll either have to wait or bless us with his presence in the laboratory. This cannot hold.
The maid dared a glance at the mortuary table where I was standing, my apron bloodied and my hands stained in death. I could see her throat bob when she swallowed.
Very well, sir, I'll tell him.
Before Uncle could utter another word, she disappeared back up the stairs. Thomas met my gaze and offered a wary smile.
If Father was here, that meant I was in trouble and would be dragged back to my gilded prison, kicking and screaming if need be.
I sighed. Father was bound to notice my absence sooner or later, and I was hardly hiding my activities from him as I used to. I might as well go to him, Uncle. Thomas can finish this lesson for me. I untied my apron and pulled it over my head. There was no need to give Father another reason to shout about my unladylike fascination with forensic medicines. I went to place the apron in the laundry bin, and Thomas gently took it from me, his fingers lingering on my gloveless hands. I lifted my gaze and found him staring down into my eyes. Even in the wake of all I'd lost, my heart found the will to beat rapidly at his touch.
"It'll all work out," he said softly, then grinned. "I could always have a word with your father. I'm not surprised he fancies me. I am rather hard to resist."
I snorted, removing my hand from his.
"I should like to see you sit down to tea with my father. Perhaps you could even tell him how many times you've indecently asked for a kiss."
"You mean how I've successfully received a kiss, I believe. If that's what the lady wants, I shall act immediately."
Thomas shrugged and made to walk up the stairs,
but I grabbed him and pointed to where Uncle was huffing across the room.
If you don't go over there and assist him, I nodded in Uncle's direction, I fear he may start throwing things.
Admit it. You're afraid your father will love me and we'll be betrothed before the night is through.
Thomas leaned closer, his lips tickling my ear in the most inappropriate manner as Uncle cleared his throat.
I rather fancy the thought of more adventures with you, Miss Wadsworth.
I shook my head. Of course, now he'd address me properly, the fiend. He pressed a chaste kiss to my hand, then stalked off toward my uncle, taking my place near the exposed brain. I watched him remove a piece of it before silently making my way upstairs. I'd miss him terribly, and a new wave of grief flooded my system. Nathaniel was gone, and now Father would banish me from my apprenticeship, taking Uncle and Thomas from me as well. I had nothing. I reached the top of the stairs and halted. Father's broad form blocked the doorway, imposing as ever. I twisted Mother's ring, all too aware it probably had droplets of dried blood on it. Father glanced over my shoulder, then settled his attention on me. He needn't say a thing. His emotions were clearly written across his face. Anyone could read their meaning. I held a hand up, tired and defeated. Nathaniel involved himself in science and ended up buried. Perhaps it was a sign I needed to give it up as well. I was tired of fighting both society and life. Giving in felt weak, but the gaping hole in my chest swallowed any burning desire to carve my own path. Please, spare me from the lecture this once. I am a shameful creature who does not deserve our good name. My breath hitched in my throat. I'd not cry now, not like this. You were right, Father. Nothing good can come from such wicked pursuits. Perhaps if Nathaniel hadn't been obsessed with such things, he'd still be alive and well now. I will not disobey your wishes again. For the first time, I meant what I said. I was not crossing my fingers behind my back, or willing to beg forgiveness later. I'd find another profession and another path to take in life. I did not fool myself into thinking I'd ever be content with staying home and tending to the house, but I'd search for some other way to fulfill my soul. Father reached for me and I flinched. His eyes grew misty.
Have I been so cruel that you fear me?
I shook my head. He'd never hit me, and I felt a new wave of shame for flinching away from him.
I've been doing some thinking.
He pulled an envelope from his overcoat pocket and inhaled deeply.
After your mother died, it was as if each shadow grew talons and claws and was threatening to steal away everything I loved.
Father stared at the envelope in his hands.
Fear is a hungry beast. The more you feed it, the more it grows. My misguided intentions were good, but I'm afraid they didn't turn out as I'd planned.
He tapped his heart.
I thought by keeping you close, keeping you safe in our home, I could protect you from such monsters.
A few moments passed, and I longed to reach out and hold him, to say something, but couldn't. There was something about this moment that felt too fragile, a bubble of soap floating above bathwater. He stood straighter and finally met my gaze.
Did you know I spoke with your uncle last week?
I drew my brows together. I'm afraid he didn't mention it. A genuine smile tugged at the corners of Father's mouth.
It's about time the ornery fool listened to me.
He handed me the envelope.
I asked him to put in a good word for you. You're brilliant and beautiful, and life has countless possibilities for you, which is precisely why I'm sending you away.
The stairwell spun before my eyes and I nearly swayed backward. This was so much worse than I could have imagined. Panic cinched my lungs together. You cannot send me away, I cried. I promise, I'll be good. No more corpses or post-mortems or police investigations, I swear. Father came forward and did the very last thing I expected him to do. He wrapped me in his arms and kissed the top of my head.
Silly child.
He said, not unkindly.
I'm sending you to a forensic medicine school. It's one of the very best in Europe. Took all of my connections and your uncle's good word to secure you a place in the class. You leave for Romania in a week.
I pulled back enough to look Father in the eyes. There was something there that stole my breath and boosted my spirit. Pride. My father was proud of me, and he was giving me the freedom I so longed for. This time when the tears came, they were for an entirely different reason. Is this truly real, or am I dreaming? I must have looked like a fish taken from the water, gulping at air. I shut my mouth and stared at Father. How he approved of this was truly miraculous. Or a delusion. I studied him, trying to decide if he'd been abusing the tonic again. He chuckled at my worried expression.
Thomas has assured us he'll watch out for you while you're both away. He's quite the responsible young gentleman, from what I hear.
My brows shot up. Thomas is... he's going too? Father nodded.
It was his idea.
Oh? I couldn't believe it. Thomas had won over my father just as he said he would. Clearly this meant the end times were near. I hugged my father, still not quite believing my luck. This is all wonderful. But why? Father held me close.
I've tried in my own way to protect you from the harshness and diseases of the world. But men and young women weren't meant to live in gilded cages. There's always a chance some contagion will find a way in. I trust you to change that. In order to do so, you must venture out into the world, my sweet girl. Promise me one thing, will you?
Anything, Father.
Always foster and grow that unquenchable curiosity of yours.
I smiled. That was a promise I fully intended to keep.
Author's note. Historical and creative liberties taken. Newspapers first used the term leather apron in regard to Jack the Ripper on September 4, not on August 31, and they referred to suspect John Pizer by name on September 7. I adjusted these dates to better serve my purposes and removed Pizer's name altogether to avoid muddling the plot with extraneous characters. On September 10, there really was a vigilante committee that formed, called the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee. Using that idea, I involved Nathaniel and Thomas, giving them a solid reason to be trolling the streets in the nights following the crimes as part of the Knights of Whitechapel. I had them out and about on September 7, the real-life evening before Annie Chapman's body was discovered, however, which is another embellishment of the historical timeline as far as the vigilante group is concerned. I also don't mention that John Pizer was arrested on September 10 as Leather Apron. There were so many men arrested as suspects, I feared it wouldn't add anything to the storyline other than confusing readers with too many names and dead ends. Arrests were made of the following men in September alone. John Pizer, Edward McKenna, Jacob Eisenschmidt, accused of being the Ripper and sentenced to the asylum, Charles Ludwig, arrested after reportedly threatening two people with a knife. Mary Ann Polly Nichols had no history of working for upper-class families in London that I could find while researching her background. I took the liberty of fictionalizing what her life could have been before she left her husband, becoming a prostitute and alcoholic, and moving from workhouse to workhouse in the early 1880s. I wanted to show the human side of these women, not just the horrific crime scenes they were a part of at the end of their lives. They were wives, mothers, sisters and daughters, not just forgotten prostitutes, remembered only in death. Emma Elizabeth Smith was someone else I fictionalized greatly. There are conflicting theories of whether she was actually an early victim of Jack the Ripper, but I really wanted her included in this novel because I was fascinated by the vagueness of her life before she became a prostitute. While there are rumors of her coming from an elite background, there's no concrete proof she was high-born. People who knew her claimed she spoke differently, meaning she had a firm grasp of proper language, which was rare for people living in the East End at that time. She said next to nothing about where she came from, which made me ask the all-important question, what if? What if she really was part of the aristocracy? There are reports that she may have known the perpetrators who had attacked her, giving me the spark of an idea to create a new background for her. The mystery surrounding her life and death was a blank canvas that I could really explore through my imagination. Annie Chapman's murder date and details of what she was wearing were as close to accurate as I could make them. She'd been drinking heavily and had used her rent money for alcohol. The lodging house deputy refused her board until she could pay, so she went out to earn some. Her husband had been paying her 10 shillings a week, but that ended in 1886 when he passed away, not in 1888, the year of her death. Elizabeth Stride is not mentioned by name in this novel, though she was one of the victims of the infamous double event. Catherine Eddowes was the second victim in the double event. I kept the date she was buried and embellished the rest about Robert James Lees meeting Audrey Rose and Thomas at the grave. He offered his assistance to Scotland Yard at this time, so I reimagined it as him offering his assistance to Audrey Rose and Thomas instead. Mary Jane Kelly was someone I tried keeping as historically accurate as possible. Some of Jack and Mary Jane Kelly's conversation and descriptions of what she was wearing the night of her death are included in the novel, although I embellished the times and sequence of how they occurred a bit. She was heard singing A Violet from Mother's Grave once she was already inside her apartment with the Ripper, not outside on the street. She was wearing a red shawl, according to one eyewitness. The home on Miller Street wasn't accessible by carriage during this time, but for the purpose of my story, I made it so, allowing Audrey Rose and Thomas a decent hiding spot for their midnight spying excursion. Facsimiles of the Dear Boss letter and the Saucy Jack postcard were actually printed on October 4 in the Evening Standard, not October 1. Earlier printings of the letters were text only on October 1 and 3 in the Star and Daily News, not picture copies of the actual letters. The Barnum and Bailey Circus didn't come to London's Olympia until November 1889, the fall following this story. But since the Queen was a fan of it, and hundreds of Victorian circuses travelled across Europe during this time period, I decided to include it. Poor Jumbo the Elephant also passed away in 1885 and wouldn't have been entertaining the crowds. Clairvoyant and spiritualist Robert James Lees was an actual man who offered his assistance to police on several occasions for the Jack the Ripper killings. While spiritualism was still quite popular across the United States and Europe, even after some spiritualists and mediums were proven to be frauds, Scotland Yard did not accept his assistance. It has never been confirmed, but there are rumours he also communicated with Prince Albert for Queen Victoria, and had even resided in the palace. I also tried keeping all medical terminology and practices as close to the date they were used as possible. Books using the term forensic medicine or forensic science were rarely printed in the 1800s. And doctors, medical examiners, used such things as body temperature to determine time of death, though they were also aware that blood loss and cold temperatures would affect the accuracy of their estimates. Joseph Lister developed the idea to sterilize instruments during surgeries in the 1860s using carbolic acid, and fingerprint identification was discovered in the early 1880s. Though they didn't have all the tools we have now, police scoured a crime scene and collected evidence much the same way in the 19th century as they do today. As stated on the New York State Troopers website, under Crime Laboratory System, Forensic Science History, the following practices were applied during the 1800s. In the 1800s, the field of forensic science saw substantial progress. The decade saw the first recorded use of question document analysis, the development of tests for the presence of blood in a forensic context, a bullet comparison used to catch a murderer, the first use of toxicology, arsenic detection, in a jury trial, the development of the first crystal test for hemoglobin using hemin crystals, the development of a presumptive test for blood, the first use of photography for the identification of criminals and documentation of evidence and crime scenes, the first recorded use of fingerprints to solve a crime, the development of the first microscope with a comparison bridge. Forensic science was significantly applied in 1888, when doctors in London, England, were allowed to examine the victims of Jack the Ripper for wound patterns. Any other historical inaccuracies not mentioned were artistic liberties I took, to enrich the world of Stalking Jack the Ripper and better serve my characters. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Stalking Jack the Ripper, written by Carrie Maniscalco, read by Nicola Barber, produced by Cheryl Smith, directed by Jared O'Connell, recorded by John Muller and Ryan Lissy, post-production by Beat Street Productions. Stalking Jack the Ripper is also available in print and digital formats from Ginny Patterson Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Carrie Maniscalco. Audio production copyright 2016 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.